Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, from the Sunsound Studios in Flagstaff. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. After a racist comment, I chose to start a conversation. When racism revealed itself in her seemingly safe community, Christine Coe found a different way to respond. By Christine Coe, March 11th, 2025. My skin started prickling the instant the postal worker asked if I was related to another Coe family. After glancing at the return address on the envelope, I handed him to weigh. When I didn't respond, taken aback by what I felt like a crossed boundary, he pressed on, telling me he thought the family was overeducated. My head filled with confrontational words, I might say, replacing the cheerful mood I had been in minutes earlier. But I stayed silent, wanting just to finish the transaction and leave. Then he asked me, "Where are you from?" The question that Asian Americans like me dread, topping it with the comment that addresses in Asian countries are a nightmare to process. Stunned and eager to escape, I asked for a receipt, turned on my heel, and strode for the exit. Just as I was about to step outside, he threw out what felt to me like the final insult. "By the way, I'm trying to learn Korean. I'm trying to learn to like Korean barbecue." I returned home furious and in tears. I shared what happened with my husband and a friend. Their reactions validated that this person's behavior was over the line. His comments called up pernicious stereotypes about Asian Americans, that we are the model minority seeking achievement or the perpetual foreigner who will always be associated with our ancestral country, even if our family immigrated generations ago. What didn't require confirmation was the awareness that I had been here before and that I wanted to scream. Growing up, racism felt confusing to me because it wasn't choosy. It could be delivered by strangers or people I knew in any type of environment. For example, through graffiti on the door of our family convenience store in Jamaica Plain, a then gritty neighborhood of Boston, or when teenagers hurled racial slurs and full soda cans at my mom and 7-year-old me in Belmont, an affluent suburb outside Boston, or when my first grade teacher humiliated me at circle time over my Korean middle name. And though you might think my armor is impenetrable, after many microaggressions and racist experiences in 51 years of life, it's unfortunately still possible to feel hurt and disempowered. Over the following weeks, I felt conflicted. Part of me didn't want to deal with the situation because wasn't January already difficult enough? But after so many years of feeling silence based on my gender and race, I knew that I needed to do something. And I had a feeling that the thing I needed to do would be incredibly hard. I spent the first week and a half after the incident stewing in fury. I was angry that this happened in the neighborhood I have called home for the past 16 years. I felt bitter that I was already carrying the burden of insult and the ball was still in my court. And then fate gave me a nudge. For my podcast, Edit Your Life, I recorded an interview with Nilanjana Dasgupta, a University of Massachusetts Amherst social psychologist and author of Change the Wallpaper, Transforming Cultural Patterns to Build More Just Communities. I asked for her advice about the post office incident, knowing that I did not want to go to management and risk getting this person fired. Dasgupta suggested direct communication. Talk to the person directly or write to the person and say how you feel or how their actions made you feel. Feelings that are hurt rather than outraged. I think hit the heart of the recipient, she advised. Over the following days, as Dasgupta's advice simmered in my mind, I felt my anger roll into sadness. Though I know racism isn't choosy, I felt disappointed that I had become complacent given the diversity of the streets around me. I felt resigned about the need to level up my armor in my neighborhood unless I wanted to switch to a different post office. My turning point emerged as I was assembling a care package for my college kid, which would need to be dropped off at a post office. As I layered Valentine's treats and my kid's favorite homemade granola between layers of tissue paper, my emotional switch flipped to calm. I felt in my bones, not just at a rational or intellectual level, that in this particular circumstance, amid these divisive times, I didn't want to be outraged. I wanted to be compassionate. I didn't want to make assumptions. I wanted to be open-minded. My purpose was simple, to communicate that our words impact one another. Part one of my mission was to not be afraid of the post office in its simplest functional sense, so I could mail my daughter's care package. Part two of my mission was to embrace the post office as a reasonably safe container in which to have an awkward conversation. I took a deep breath and said to myself, hard times require courage, and walked in. A different employee, a black woman, was at the counter. After we finished our transaction, I looked at my receipt from 3 weeks prior and asked if the clerk, listed by number, would be on shift later that day. He was, in fact, in the back. The clerk, a white man, came out. I explained that I was there 3 weeks ago and that I left very upset based on what he said to me. I repeated back the comments that felt offensive. And my main message was this: whether we're online or in community with strangers or people we know, our words matter. I told him that I was there because I wanted him to know how his words made me feel and to give him the opportunity to share where he was coming from. He seemed to experience an emotional roller coaster of his own, though on a scale of minutes, not weeks. At first, He seemed surprised. He stood up a little straighter and reared back slightly, eyes widening. Flustered, he said that how I interpreted his words was not his intent, and he apologized quickly. Then he seemed defensive, sharing that he tries to be friendly and that if a return address said Yastrzemski, he would ask if the person was related to Carl Yastrzemski. He followed with, "Fine, next time I will just say hi and bye and that's it." And then, perhaps because the other employee and a customer were bearing witness to this exchange, he seemed embarrassed. As I tried to say that I did in fact want our community to be able to chat and be friendly, he shut down. He wouldn't look at me. His eyes were cast down, glued to the postal calculator device while his fingers punched at it, even though there was no weighing or measuring to be done other than the conversation between us. I didn't want to push it, so I thanked him for his time and left. The interaction wasn't perfect. I wish I had closed by sharing first names, shaking hands, and saying, "Let's move forward." But hard moments are rarely perfect. It occurred to me after I left that the big difference between what had just happened and so many racial incidents in my past was that I could be choosy. I chose to be brave. I chose to question my own assumptions. I chose to use my voice and invite someone into the conversation. And though it might seem like a minor thing, because of these choices, I don't need to avoid this post office. I hope that small interactions in the future will lead to repair and a congenial relationship with this individual. The small steps of resistance and change start right in our own neighborhoods. About the author. Christine Coe is a former music and brain scientist turned writer, podcaster, and creative director. You can find her work at her website and connect via Substack, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Facebook. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. How to get good at conflict. According to a new book, there are lots of tools we can learn to help us sit with conflict and grow from it. By Janara Nirenberg, March 12, 2025. Joel Salinas, a Harvard neurologist, and Robert Bordone, a Harvard lawyer, are experts in the study of conflict. But their communication styles are quite different. Salinas, with over a decade of experience sitting side by side with his neurology patients, possesses a gentle, sensitive nature and isn't accustomed to engaging too intensely. Bordone, accustomed to heated negotiations in high conflict settings, feels perfectly at home with more tense interactions. Writing their new book, Conflict Resilience, was an opportunity to learn more about their own styles and the styles of others and share those insights with readers. While we often talk about resolving disagreements, whether at home or in international politics, The two co-authors think that embracing conflict has more to do with accepting differences as opposed to erasing those differences. That is, learning to sit with the discomfort of disagreement is a vital skill we should all develop, and understanding how to build resilience in the face of conflict is a much more realistic goal than agreement or resolution. Of course, agreement will be possible at times, and other times when it's unhealthy for you, conflict should not be engaged in. But for the rest of the time, there are tools like breathwork, parts work, and reframing that can help you get more comfortable with the uncertainty of disagreement and uncomfortable conversations. Salinas and Bourdon spoke with Greater Good about what they discovered while writing their new book. Janara Nirenberg, let's start with the three-step framework you explore in the book. Can you explain that for us? Robert Bourdon, J.D. Our three-part framework is called Name, Explore, Commit. We think it's very unique and important. Readers have people in their lives who they are stuck with in terms of having disagreements. But the counterintuitive part of our book is starting with our own selves, naming our own internal stories, identities, and conflicts that can drive why we have unproductive responses to conversations and negotiations. Naming invites people to name different parts of themselves that are in conflict. Exploring is the engagement piece of conflict itself. How does one sit with disagreement, and what skills are required? How does one become an effective listener and also find ways to assert your perspective? Commit takes the reader through questions around how to continue to engage with the person, whether the goal is agreement or not. If we can't resolve an issue, then the question becomes how to address the issue and move forward. If we want to keep talking about it, then how? There are some relationships that need to be exited, and there are some that are difficult to fully exit, like a sibling or a family member. In the book, one of our goals is to increase our ability to sit with conflict, but to distinguish between that and harm or trauma. Joel Salinas, MD. When we talk about the commit step and conflict resilience in general, we're not advocating for people to endure harm or situations that they should not be in. Part of conflict resilience includes developing the wisdom around what is a conflict that I should sit with and which is a conflict that is perhaps not the right timing for me. And it boils down to whether the person on the other side is engaging in good faith or not. Janara Nirenberg, can you explain more about the internal work we need to do before entering a conflict conversation? Robert Bourdon. The beginning of the book draws on internal family systems and how different parts of ourselves come together. We discuss something called mirror work, which is just identifying our different parts. And then chair work is using actual chairs where individuals come together to set up chairs to reflect each of their different parts when preparing to discuss a conflict and designate which chair represents which part so that everybody knows in order to give those parts a voice. The prep work becomes extremely helpful for the table work, which is sitting there for actual conversation. Your job becomes to make all of those chairs and voices get represented. It's often a nice way to enter the conversation, like, there's a side of me that really wants to bring this up with you, and there's a side of me that really doesn't, and there's a side of me that's scared or unsure, and there's a side that's more sure. All of that can really help during a conversation. Joel Salinas. I think understanding your own contours and the contours of the other person and negotiating those are essential pieces of understanding what's going on for you internally and what could be going on for the other person, and then having a frank discussion about all of the messiness, having a language for it, or at least an opportunity to understand that there's something to uncover there, can help to create that collective dialogue you're going to have with the other person. Janara Nuremberg. What is happening inside the brain when people perceive threat, like in a conflict? Joel Salinas. Our brain evolved as a fortune-telling machine. It's there to take past experiences and inform what might happen so that way we can take action to avoid or decrease pain or negative experiences, which in turn helps us to survive. But what's happened over time without the saber-toothed tiger there is that we still get overwhelmed and perceive what can potentially harm us. Many of us learn from a young age by watching family members and films and other influences that conflict is scary and to be avoided, and that conflict is a sign of failure. When we encounter a situation that our brain registers as conflict, if we see it as potentially negative enough, it starts to set off alarm bells in our brain. It says, pay attention, this is negative. And it sets off our fight, flight, freeze, fawn, and fester responses. These are systems that increase adrenaline, stress hormones, heart rate, blood pressure, and muscle contraction, and that informs your brain that there's a threat going on. That can either escalate conflict or you shut down. So one of the things we're exploring in the book is how to break these habitual cycles by doing breath work. One specific study we looked at examined different types of breath work, and what I loved about this study is that it's very practical. There's one specific type of breath work that stood out in terms of its ability to reduce stress, anxiety, and heart rate variability and respiratory rate. It's called cyclic sighing. What you do is you take a deep breath through the nose, and once you get to the top of the breath, you just do a little bit of extra breath in through the nose, and then a slow exhale. That little top off at the end of your inhale expands the alveoli just a little bit more, giving you a little vagal stimulation. Having that specific type of breath work during potential conflicts can really help to bring other brain systems online that are much more deliberative and able to support you to discern next steps, be curious, and be more tactical in asserting your own interests. We also explore beginning to envision what the reward might be in sitting through disagreements and uncomfortable dialogue. This begins to reprogram the brain and rewire it, but it also helps to align our brain with our intentions and what we really want for ourselves, as opposed to just defaulting to shutting down or avoiding disagreement. If you need to ask for a raise or a promotion, being afraid of conflict is not going to help you. Being in a relationship where there are things that need to be talked about and you're scared to address conflict is also not good. Robert Bourdon. Most think conflict is bad, but conflict is part of life. When it's surfaced in a productive way, that's a good thing because it means that people feel that they can put themselves forward. So a mind shift toward thinking of conflict as not bad can go a long way. One of my observations in teaching law students was that we worked hard to recruit people with different political views, but our classroom discussions were somehow dull and boring. When we started to unpack that and ask people what was going on, they said that the cost of speaking up was too high for reasons like being canceled or getting called out online or on social media. People also felt like they didn't have much in common and they didn't see the point. But even if you can't agree or solve a problem, the act of sitting with discomfort humanizes the other person and prevents dehumanization and demonization. If you look at dialogue across differences like Israeli-Palestine conflicts, even if views don't shift, the stories that people tell about one another shift, and their relationships are genuine and real. So I've come to feel that we need to persuade people that this work is worthwhile. As Joel said, our brains learn about conflict from an early age, and it's not comfortable to sit with discomfort, and it's easier not to. So what's the upside? People have to be persuaded that there is value in this. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff, bringing you Greater Good Magazine. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.